Yes, a period for Dharma inquiry. I'll take a couple of minutes to give the general outline. And besides me, there's a microphone and a couple of meditation cushions. And this time is an open invitation for anyone who may wish to come and take the seat here. With the guidelines for the inquiry time, fairly simple, to be rather present focused. And what I mean by that, in terms of the time here on the retreat. So it's not about other places, environments, situations, and elsewhere. But we keep to the priority areas of interest, experience, concerns, questions, and the opportunity for some dialogue together. So out of the days that you've been here, the areas of interest or concern or questions may arise from your meditations, pardon me, of course, may arise from the instructions, from experiences, one-to-ones, teachings and talks, guided meditations, and much, much else. And with the invitation to come, some exchange, communication takes place between the person and myself with the intentionality that it's contributing to insight and understanding for each and every one of us without any exception whatsoever. There is the useful escape clause in the communication, and that is that the person or I, at any time, whenever it feels appropriate, to say thank you, to bring the inquiry to a close. Sometimes with the inquiry, they'll might last 5 or 10 minutes, and sometimes 20 minutes, half an hour, whatever seems useful. There, with this inquiry, person may ask myself questions. If they're easy, I'll answer, obviously. and if they're not, I'll probably ask the same question back to the person in another way and hope they don't realize what I'm doing. So this is the exchange with the inquiry time. For those who are listening, the act of listening is one of the great events of human life. And with the listening, it's a total event. Therefore, it's both outer and inner listening, in this case, two people who are engaging together, and also, in equally important, listening inwardly. And noticing and being as clear and mindful as possible about what the responses are as you, as I, as we listen. And sometimes that might evoke empathy. That woman's voice, that man's voice, what he is relating is very similar to your experience, to your concerns, and there's natural empathy. May awaken some real interest there, but also, and equally, of course, there may be some reactive voice inside, the judgmental voice. It's as boring as all those Hollywood films, or it's making me feel agitated, or it's not going anywhere, or whatever. So we do want to be able to catch in life, in our listening, what the inner voice is saying as well. And the teachings, incidentally, gave enormous emphasis on this. Those who love listening, in this case to the Buddha, are often referred as shravanas, the ones who listen, the listening ones. And so things often went from listening to practice, from listening to application, from listening to insight, from listening to realization, from listening to waking up. So there's a certain intimacy there. Anyone can come at any time, as I mentioned, on experiences, meditations, reflections, points that have been said in the teachings and talks and much, much else. When the Sankhya is said, there is a minute or two of shared silence together. I'll then make another invitation, and then another person is very welcome to come and to take the seat. So this is the outline of the inquiry. There, remember, you can say thank you at any time, and anyone who wishes to come and sit and have some exchange together, there's a microphone for each of us, and that will make it easier for the good listening ones in the other far realm over there. Okay, yes, anyone please. Hi. What's your name?
David.
David. Yeah, yes, David.
During these few days we're here, we've been exploring.
Can you hear? So the mic has to be a little and switched on, is it?
All right.
Okay.
During these few days we've been exploring several methods or maybe aspects of practice,
yes,
meditation. Starting with Lila, which we're referring to a general view over the body and over everything.
Yes.
Then, I don't remember the exact order, but Stephen were talking about the importance of being here in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking about the importance of inquiry. Mm-hmm. And so on. And now when I sit to meditate, and with all my intentions of all of these, with inner compassion and whatever, right this time I would love to have some words of guidance.
Sure.
When I sit, what do I do?
Yeah. All right. Well, try and answer this. Let me just ask, I'll respond fully, but let me just ask a little bit. We enter into an environment. We enter into an environment. This is the environment. And we listen to instructions. There are the voices of authority. And with the voices that come, there is, as you pointed out, the encouragement, references made to the breath, references made to the body, references made to feelings, to happiness, to inquiry, to reflection of what leads up to what. And these different voices can come in, compassion, as you just mentioned. So far, for you, what have you done with all of these meditation approaches? When you sit down, what actually happens for you? Having heard, I agree, a range of different instructions, what's the result for you?
Well, usually, sometimes after that, it might be at the same time when I hear this instruction or the next sit.
Yes.
I find myself more into these instructions. I mean, if it was talking about compassion, then I'm into compassion. If it's talking about feelings, then I'm into feelings or whatever.
Is the sense of feeling level, it could be, and could be for the same for others as well, it could feel quite confusing. It could feel these different aspects are mentioned, and I find myself jumping from one to the other. Just a little dip here, a little dip there. Is that how it is for you?
It could be sometimes, yes. Sometimes.
Alright, so it's hardly likely that the three of us are going to shut up from this evening. and it could get worse. Who's on duty for the instructions? Leela tomorrow morning, etc. So, there's the exploration, genuine encouragement, as I said. What do you find would be a skillful way to deal with these different approaches and all sharing the same spirit, but what would be a way so that it is not confusing, it is quite clear for you, and you know exactly what you're going to do when you sit, walk, stand and recline?
Well, actually, well, the only thing I could come up with, which I already came up with, was I sit and I see what comes up and I follow. Meaning, if I sense that my mind is wandering around, then I'll focus myself on being here with the body.
Yes.
If there's some issue bothering me, then I'll take some minutes to concentrate on the body, and then I'll try to investigate stuff like that. But sometimes it came out just like the question rose like the last two sessions.
Yes.
Because this is what I do usually, but then I found myself overloaded with information and instruction.
Right.
But this is what I do.
All right, fair enough. So, and it is a risk, and it's a genuine possibility of the overload of information. And are you finding, therefore, that in your meditations, it's you're looking at what's taking place, and then there's switching and changing going on in the meditation as the changes go on?
Yeah, that could be. Yeah.
I mean, it could be. Tell me, it's your life.
No, you ask if I experienced that.
Yes.
Yes, I did.
What's the value of going along those lines? So there are some experience of watching, and then one explores that, and then there may be some reflection, and one brings that in, and then there may be something else. What's the value of that? What is helpful for you with regard to that?
Well, moving from one thing to another.
Exactly.
Mm. Well, I guess there is a value. I mean, that I experience all aspects of practice in the same...
You'd be lucky. Better carry on.
Yeah.
Go on. All right. Some aspects of practice. All right.
Yeah.
What's the limitation of an approach so that there can be genuinely, and I'm with you, a genuine development taking place of learning to work with what is, make use of some diversity that's been offered, trust in one's own way of working with it, and that may, as you point out, include changes through the meditation. I feel quite fine with it. What's the limitations of such approach and such an attitude in the meditations, if any?
Well, I guess in some way...
is it a guess or is it actual?
My life is actually full of guesses.
Your life is full of guesses.
I'm joking.
Go on.
I think there could be some limitations. I mean, if I find myself spread and jumping from one thing to another, it's very difficult to answer that, because usually my jumping from one technique or method or approach to another is mediated by dreaming or flying away, or so it's very difficult to answer that. But I think its limitation is if I'm, from my experience, if I'm sitting and I'm focused on my body for this.
Can you hear it over there?
So, as you said, if I'm lucky to most of the time to be focused on my body, then I get up from meditation and I feel that I did a good work.
Okay, nice, nice to hear.
But if I jumping, then it's another feeling. I don't know. Usually, the teacher said there is no success and failure in this kind of practice. So I don't know how to relate to that. But I feel less.
Not me. Good, carry on.
Less something.
Mm. All right. So if I hear the good words there. There's a sequence and a process which is taking place. The vulnerability of it, the limit of it, could be of jumping there. So that would be a kind of impulsive movement from one thing to the other. And it could be interrupted quite a lot with daydream, spacing out thoughts and ideas, and then coming back. And that's certainly worth being very clear about if one is changing the approach through the period of time, while recognizing, as you said earlier, the changing way also can be genuinely helpful there. Then you just mentioned, and it sounded in the tone a bit more positive from you, about being with the body. Why would that be? Just expand a little bit on the being with the body. And you said, when I've meditated and I've stayed with the body through the meditation, mindfulness of body practice.
Maybe I was sounded positive about it, because I think being with the body is the most, we have a quick feedback. The sense of feedback.
A feedback.
Not an intellectual feedback. I cannot.
No.
But the feeling.
Yeah. Yeah.
When right. I'm sitting, I like being benefit. Very. I can feel the sense of being benefit.
Right.
Very quickly, immediately. Right. I mean, when I finish.
Right. So, with giving attention to the experience of the body, as you point out, the body gives feedback. In the form of pleasure and pain, in the form of its elements and organic life, in the form of sensations and vibrations, in the forms of change. So you're staying with the body. The body is giving a variety of different feedbacks which are coming to you. And you realize at the end of the sitting the benefit of that. Did the other... The changing, adapting, going along, is that providing at the end of the meditation the same affirmative response?
Well, it depends. I mean, sometimes.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. From my own experience, if there is a period of time, like a few days, a few weeks, which I'm busy with something and I'm dealing with something, so and I can jump. I usually focus on my breath and body, okay, when I usually sit, but I'm dealing with it for several days or more, and then I can see the benefit of it.
So maybe
it's just an assumption. It's a matter of the period of time I'm talking to. But, I mean, the body, when I said feedback, not just the immediate feedback when I'm sensing this pleasant sensation or unpleasant sensation. Yeah. I mean, when I doing like 40 minutes meditation and I'm more or less focused on my body, I feeling like benefited from it.
Okay.
This is the kind of feedback I meant.
All right.
And it's in the short term and in the long term, maybe it's just guesses, but maybe.
We'll keep to the short term, so that we're less guessing. So in the listening, meditate on the body. So ask and listening to you, the value of the practice of the meditating on the body, in this case, will contribute to the grounding and being more centered. There's a genuine sense and feeling at the end of the sitting. It is beneficial. So there's an immediate affirmation and response that it's might be painful and difficult, but worthwhile. that appreciation can be in equally in all four postures. There, that grounding and centering and staying steady and true to that will contribute, because there's more depth, more samadhi, staying true to that will allow more clarity in the movement that you spoke of previously. So first with the body, with the immediacy, which hasn't got any guessing going on, you know, with it, and then some expansion. Okay, thank you. Great. Okay, thank you. So we have a quiet minute and then another invitation. Yes, anyone, anytime. Yes. What's your name?
Anne.
Anne, okay, yes.
I would like to relate to Lila's talk today.
To Lila's talk, yes.
Mm-hmm. So you said, Lila, that oftentimes we go in the world with a self-image. Of being this or that.
Yes.
And then we attract the confirmation for that.
Mm.
I agree.
I appreciate. I wasn't at the talk. It would have been hard to understand.
Excuse me?
I wasn't at the talk. It would have been rather hard to understand. It was in Hebrew, right? Yes, that's... So, but carry on. So she said, you're reporting that Lila said that an image arises...
We adopted a self-image.
Yeah, we adopt a certain self-image, and that image, as it were, so to speak, goes out in front of us. You know,
yeah.
It gets presented to others, and then?
And then we get confirmation of that.
We get confirmation.
We attract confirmation. So we strengthen our self-image, even though... It's not very comfortable or enlightening.
Yeah. Mm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing that I experienced
mm-hmm.
From in the same kind of thing is the calling name. People call other people's name.
Yes.
Yeah, like you are this and you are that, and specifically that they call me names.
Yes, other than Anne.
Maybe because my parents only gave me one, so they need to add more. And I just don't know when it happens. It usually feels very bad. And now I think I have been already working on that, and yes. I don't think I am giving this image, this self-image that I had in the past, maybe. And still people call me name.
All right. So there's not much opportunity for that to happen here, but or maybe in the next 5 minutes we'll see. Anyway, in a way, the word "an" is an image. In a way, it's a word. It's a picture. It's an image. There. And you said, in the past, I used to have an image of myself, and I would present this, and it might attract approval, disapproval, praise and blame, and all that stuff. There. And sometimes we have worked a lot on ourselves, and say some of that image or picture or view has faded away. But even if the image has faded away, will that protect us from what other people say? If we have not presenting any particular image, does that give us any security or safety from, does it give you any?
No, of course not.
Of course not. So?
Well, my question would be, my reaction usually to people calling me names.
Now you really got me curious. Tell me a couple of names.
They call me aggressive.
Aggressive.
Angry.
Angry.
It's
the same thing, really.
Yeah.
Is it true?
And variations.
Is it true?
Well, I used to have some anger in me, and sometimes it's still.
So the names are still being used that says, Anne, you're aggressive, you're angry, but their image is from the past more than from the present.
No. So I mean, I can, well, you know, you apologize about being English, try being French. So I think part of the reaction I get is when I speak in a more French way of speaking.
And it's
often very decisive.
Listen to the talk today. There is some image which arises. And as you say, as I said, we cannot protect ourselves. So from the voices of others. If we are getting feedback, definitely it's important that we take notice of. We may not realize the tone or the attitude in the voice, especially for sensitive people, can be felt and experienced as being angry and aggressive. It may not be one's intention, but sensitive people will pick it up quite quickly with the voice, whether we're French or English, Israeli or all of that. So in the hearing of the voices of others, even though there is no wish to, what in your meditations here would be worth exploring and looking at, so that any anger and aggression is not part of your experience? What ways could you use, helpfully and useful, your meditations here? So that one can put hand on heart and say, largely, the anger and fear is out of this system, since there is still some left. And some is far too much.
I think I should be more concentrated on feelings arising, and mostly those feelings are of agitation and, right. And
okay. All right, that's good. So when we look to more deep inside and connect with the feelings, one expression can be some agitation. Is agitation always aggression and anger? Is agitation always aggression and anger?
Well, as you said, it's often fear.
Yeah, we'll keep out the other from the fear for a moment. Just keep with the big question. Is agitation...
The volume up.
Ask Guruji over there. There. Alright. And if it is difficult to hear, you can come and sit right here. No problem. So, back to the question here. Is agitation, feel some agitation. Mm-hmm. You get to the end of the food line and there's no food left, you know, etc. You come in and your cushion is under somebody else's bum, etc. You see somebody walking off with your nice sandals down the road. Is the agitation that which is felt always anger and aggression?
I think the agitation is agitation.
Right.
And the aggression or anger would be a reaction to this agitation.
All right, nice. Good. worth remembering. So there's some agitation inside the being. And that agitation very easily and humanly, the self identifies with the agitation, and then I become angry because things are not how I want them to be. There. So, I would agree, the anger or the aggression is a reaction against the normal response of some agitation. There. How will you know when you've slipped from agitation into aggression?
If I act upon this agitation, it will usually be aggressive.
Okay. So, let me ask, since you arrived here, has any of us really pissed you off?
Well, I went to get food and there was no food left.
Is that right?
Yes.
They're
and
a hungry
I got
lot
pissed
here.
Off.
Eh? You go, all right.
But I didn't do nothing about it. I just took a few bits and right. sat in silence.
Is the impression, of course, I'm in the privileged circles with the team, is that there's bucket loads of food around. I'm just wondering, what time did you turn up? Was it right in the line, the food had gone?
It was yesterday noon.
Yesterday noon, all right. Okay, so what's...
There was food.
There was food. I'm sure, yeah, sorry. Okay.
There was no cabbage left.
Here we go. Confession time. There was no cabbage left. How can I live without my cabbage? Alright, okay. Was the pissed off, taking the mic, was the pissed off, use my words, a little unfair on you, but was that a language of agitation or a language of aggression? Was it a language of reaction or a language of some agitation? It's not there.
Well, it's a very quick reaction.
Aggression. That's aggression.
Yeah, sure.
All right. Back to the question. What will, because the movement between angry with regard, the normal, the agitations of life. Can't imagine any human being not experiencing agitation. The Buddha of the Buddhas would experience agitation if the cabbage was gone. What will help to make it clear between the agitation and when it's gone into the aggression and the anger and the blaming and the pointing the finger at the wonderful cooks or whatever? What would tell you, wow, I've gone just from some agitation, it's not there, to the aggression? That movement is a powerful one to observe, to notice. No. I mean, you kind of have said it in various ways, and it, genuinely, it's a difficult question. Something happens and there's some agitation. Being human. And then the I, the me, the my, identifies with it. As you said, it generates a reaction. In the reaction that comes, the thought or the voice or the action of aggression, negativity, fault-finding, blame, hostility, resentment, all of that comes in the reaction. Can we notice, I'm only repeating the question, can we notice the movement from the agitation into all of that negative stuff which people have criticized you for in the past?
When I noticed that there was no cabbage left.
Yes.
And I didn't eat in the evening because I decided not to eat supper.
Oh, yes.
And so I arrived to the lunch quite hungry.
Yes.
And I hardly eat rice.
No.
So there was really not much for me to eat.
No. Mm.
And my first idea was I write them a note. So it's not fair. I don't have enough food. I don't have anything to eat. And then I said, no, there is enough to eat.
Mm.
And there's no point writing a note. I've been working in the kitchen and I know how difficult it is.
Good spirit. Nice.
So it's okay. I just eat what's there and right. I calm down.
Ah. All right. Lovely. The very, healthy, skillful, wise, attitude. So in the agitation, the voice of, oh, I'll write a note. Then something stronger came in this case empathy. You know what it's like to serve others. You know the tremendous work that's going on in the kitchen on behalf of all of us. And the empathy allowed the quietening down of the agitation. And actually, there's enough. It's that response which reflects the transformation of aggression and anger. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, a minute or two of the quiet. Yes, anyone? Sorry.
My name is Moshe.
Moshe, yes.
And first of all, given that it's probably the last time I'll be holding this mic, I wanted to thank you guys, the teachers, especially Lila in my case, but all of you have been great guidance. And to the team that Tal and Itamar and the kitchen, of course, it's been really great and smooth, so thank you. Except the cabbage. But okay, so we know that humans, non-meditator humans, usually have this tragedy of either living in the past or in the future. So regretting something from the past or worrying about something in the future. And what you've been teaching us, and really it's one of the presents that you're giving us, is the present in a way. So the question is, in everyday life, you do need to plan sometimes. You do need to think about the future. You do need to learn from your past. So the question is, how do you characterize the cases where you actually do need you do feel it's okay to worry about the future. It's okay to think, to plan.
Well, it's a good point and a good question. Initial response, it would sound like perhaps an exaggerated emphasis on the present. What is the difference between worrying about the future and planning about it? For you.
You're asking me? Well, you planned your trip here from the UK, I'm assuming. It might have occurred to you there will be a strike in Israel, there will be a war again. So into the plans of the pragmatic. into the pragmatics, creeping in some.
Does the behavior of people outside of myself, called institutions or called governments or whatever, or airlines, corporate world, should that have enough impact to stimulate worry? Because that, therefore, it's right and appropriate to worry.
Well, the question is, do you limit future-oriented thinking to pragmatics, and that's it? Is this a good kind of rule of thumb? I know it's a bad phrase.
No, I don't. So, are there any other alternatives to a relationship to the future, for you, so it's not theoretical, which are neither pragmatic nor with worry?
Well, let's stick to the subject of traveling. So you have to travel from A to B, and you can connect in two different cities, and you can say, oh, in this city last time I lost my luggage.
Okay, so there the day going by, some imagination comes, and humanly enough, it goes to the future, maybe some pragmatic element. It may be some speculative element factor. It may carry some worry in it. To come back to the question, therefore, what is worry with it feeding into the future? What is this phenomena of worry, which is, as we know, it's like an epidemic, it's widespread, and we might think, well, everybody is worrying and they have good reason to worry. Maybe there is no good reason to worry. What is this worry for you? What do you worry about?
Well, you can think about a scenario at work, for example, right?
It's something. Love scenarios. God,
yes.
You love them. All right, carry on. All right, okay. Work.
Well, you think about it, a certain case that might go wrong, and yes. I think part of worries, generally, not only about me, even though you like me to talk about myself, involves rumination, right? That you're yes. continuously thinking about the same thing. It's all not right. only that you entertain five possible alternatives, you're stuck to maybe the most negative one, and you keep
right.
circling.
Very
so that's
good.
Rumination.
All right. Follow. You said some important words there, and worth mirroring back. So, a thought, an idea or a picture or an image arises with regard to tomorrow or next week or whatever. As you say, in my case, and I'm sure with other people here, it is quite necessary that I plan. I have to meet contact with the organizations and networks, etc. And it's usually a year or 16 months ahead what the dates are and what's to be done. And then there are situations which come from the present moment, which can be challenging. I do not know what the outcome will be. You know, it could be health of a family member, it could be all sorts of changes that are going on. And therefore I know the causes and conditions for today could lead to something unwelcome for tomorrow. Tomorrow, next week, next month, next year. And many people will know this extremely well there. And with that movement of the inner to the future, something can go on in the inner life which adds something more to it, which is a stress. Worry is a stress. And the stress can go through the body, it can go through the feelings, it can go into the speech, and as you said, it's the habit of going and repeating something, ruminating and repeating something, and the more the ruminating, the more the repeating, the building up of the stress about something which may or may not happen. Do you want to live like that?
Of course not.
Of course not. What's going to end it? Completely. One can put hand on heart and say, I'm not worrying about the future.
Well, you kind of distorted the question. I made you distort the question. Well, okay, so what would stop you? Obviously, if people stop ruminating, they stop worrying, right? So they should think about all the alternatives and then give them equal weight.
Okay, so since you introduced the word worry here, what kind of alternative might be helpful for you? So you don't worry. Reduce the worry. You work on the
not think about the future.
Not think about it. You'll be lucky. Eh? Have you ever met a human being who doesn't have thought about the future?
No, I thought that's where you were leading me to. So I guess not worrying would mean maybe the understanding there's nothing you can do about it, and you know all possibilities are open. And
all right. I mean, maybe helpful. Sometimes, though, I think, and I'm sure you do as well, I look at something in the future, and I say, in the present, or in the future, I can respond and act to that, and I can do something about it. Sometimes. I can do something about it, and one does. And there are other situations I look at, I cannot do anything about it. I'm just a human being and I cannot do anything about it. But I know that worrying about that which I cannot do is kind of madness. Isn't it?
It makes a lot of sense. The question is, do people are people convinced by this?
Are you?
I'm not so worried so much. No. I just define worry for a question. But I think it will take more than just saying that it's madness to believe it, right?
Agree. I couldn't agree more. So we may have a sense that in some things we can act in the future, as you said, and some things we can't. There, and yet we can look inside. We can ask, what's the impact? What's the feelings and thoughts? And I'll give a little indication of what I mean. Could there be worry without fear?
I think so, yes.
You like scenarios. Tell me one.
Well, I worry that it will rain tomorrow and they'll cancel my flight, but I know that the worst case, I'll take the flight the day after. So it's not fear. Right.
No, not fear. So it wouldn't be correct to say, I am afraid they will cancel the flight tomorrow, and I can take the day after. Isn't fear and worry rather close?
Yeah, because worry, I mean, I worry because it will make me, it will be a nuisance. I'll have to risk it, change some plans, but I'm not afraid of it.
No. All right, okay. Yeah. So, the worry in this case wouldn't have the same impact. But supposing you started really ruminating on the fact you may not get the flight. Would that be likely to increase the worry?
It will increase anxiety.
Anxiety. Yes. All right, we'll increase the anxiety. So there is a relationship between the intensity of the ruminating and the feeling stressful impact of it, call anxiety, or call worry, or call fear. So, the thinking has a bearing and an impact on the consequence. Stress, worry, etc. What's useful, what's a pragmatic way to cut down on the ruminating in order that we cut down, therefore, on the anxiety, the worries, and the fear?
Well, I was hoping you have the answers for this.
I do, but you're going to tell me them.
Uh-huh. So the question was, if you take, for example, we can talk about clinical disorders such as depression, for example. Yes. So people there's often something that's called comorbidity, that people in depression also suffer from anxiety. Yes. And all of this, as in the root of it, has something, the rumination thing, right? And the idea here is, how do you take a patient, somebody who has all this rumination rooted in their pattern of thinking, mm-hmm. and tell them, oh, it's madness. Why are you worried about this? There's nothing you can do about it anyway.
No.
It's not going to help. So the question is, can you really convince somebody deep down to stop ruminating because it doesn't make sense?
No. So clearly I would have thought from the general instructions here, we don't think that the three of us can convince people to stop ruminating. I wish we could. I would love it. I would come here and I'd just convince everybody, stop ruminating, and then go home, back to England. So, we share and offer practices. We listen there. We offer teachings there. And one aspect of that is the excessive use of thought. Because rumination requires some thinking. And remembering, just on the point you mentioned with regard to depression, there are people in the hall who are very, very familiar with depression, and there's a wide variety of ways of looking at it, and I wouldn't put all of it into the ruminating box. But coming back there, we are saying thought and healthy thought genuinely has a really helpful place, but excessive thought is not healthy for the human being, and as we agree, it easily, with the negativity in it, easily intensifies the stresses, anxieties and worries. And I said, can we catch that early enough, quietly enough, and finding ways and means to feel more connected with life, and in some way, really taking care of today, with the pragmatic considerations for tomorrow, and much more about the relationship of the human being of the present to the future.
Perfect answer. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you for coming. Thank you. Perfect answer. You're too kind. So have a quiet minute. Just take a moment or two just to give a short reflection here. And thank you for the good voices to, coming to take the seat. And as we listen, so much of the journey is a journey from the inner to the outer. And that which is within us very easily has its movement, it finds its expression, and and then it goes to the outer. And the tracking or the following of the inner life is such that if we're not easy, but as clear as possible, we can notice and we can pick up on sometimes on the moments of a change taking place. And the mindfulness, the clear comprehension, is just to connect with those changes, and in some way or other to see and to recognize if anything else is added into the process, if anything else is taking place in the process. And some exploration of this is important. So as we were listening there with the meditation process, and I'm sure the good person's voice mirrored and reflected a number of other voices here. So we look at one exploration, both referred to are valid, of being with what is, working with it, having the flexibility and the adaptability to change as we go along, using some reflection and recognizing at times some distraction, some thoughts, some daydreams arising, and just being with that dynamic, seeing that unfolding, becoming, process taking place, and just know that it is going on. The vulnerability of that, of course, is that we can get lost in it, that there's not enough depth inside the being, and there's a lack of quality of a certain power of calm and concentration. And if we don't have the power of the calm and concentration, if something very strong arises, we will be overwhelmed with it. So as long as it, as I was listening, relatively comfortable, I'm mindful and clearly comprehending this is going on, I'm making the changes as we usefully heard and going with it. But if something explosive happened, a drama, a volcanic eruption happened in the inner life, there needs to be enough calmness and concentration to really be clear that is part of that process. So, the Buddha's emphasis, mindfulness and concentration, are two very important, indispensable factors that go together. We may need to look at ourselves, and sometimes we look and we say, actually, I need more samadhi. And that means more steadiness on the particular, could be called the breath, it could be called the body, as the good man was reminding us, and staying steady with that, with a quiet stillness that goes with it, letting that deepen, not reaching out and grasping on to what's around, and in the calm and steadiness and deepening, that samadhi develops. And then, when it feels skillful and appropriate, we open the attention out from the place of some inner stillness, that's the samadhi, to be able to look at the movement that's going on in the inner life. With some reflection, some daydream, making allowances for those movements, and when that's working well and clearly and helpfully for us, we will come to the end of the meditation in any of the four postures, and there genuinely will be a sense that was really useful, healthy, helpful meditation. The sense, the intuition will tell you that. And it is valuable to have the flexibility to explore both ways and other ways. It's all part of the exploration of the inner world. We also listen to the moment. And it is understandable, but very, very easy to regard any kind of movement in the inner life as somehow a confirmation of something unresolved and problematic. It's not helpful, nor is it healthy. That there is this, as we go into the deeper within ourselves, it's important to be clear that some movements that go on in feelings, like the good lady said, agitation, those kind of agitations which arise,